Hello, I'm Renee Vaughan Sutherland, and welcome to Greater Than 11%, a weekly podcast that explores roles and opportunities within the creative industries, with the aim of contributing to increasing diversity across the board, in addition to promoting some awesome women. Episode 37, I'm joined by printmaker and illustrator Kate Gibbs. Kate took art and design and textiles at A-levels, where she experienced, for the first time, the photographic silkscreen process. She went on to train as a textile designer, being drawn to the colour and pattern before switching to printmaking. Working from her studio in London, where we're conducting this interview, she has created artwork for Apple, Virgin Records, Creative Review, Penguin Books, The Guardian and Observer, Hermes, British Vogue, The Chemical Brothers, to name but a few. She recently collaborated with Tom Wood, creating a limited edition of design prints for t-shirts and sweaters for their spring-summer 2019 collection. Colour and pattern are what makes Kate's work more than grab your attention. Her prints saturate your senses, draw you in, and demand you have a conversation with them. They are often constructed collage or pictorial elements, layered and intertwined with shapes in varying hues and textures. Whilst they immediately feel familiar, you can still feel a little lost while simultaneously being centered as your eyes sift through the imagery. Kate's process is a combination of experience, 20 years, and experimentation, entrusting serendipity and chance to play a significant part in each creation. Kate is also an arts educator, having taught or been visiting lecture at a number of UK universities, such as the London Metropolitan, Bath School of Art, and Westminster University. Kate, the smell of your studio and my feverish desire to open all your print drawers so I can fawn all over your beautiful work is intoxicating. I love screen printing, never done it myself, and it's been on my must-do creative list for years. So it's with called up excitement to welcome you to Greater Than 11%.
Wow, thank you. That was a lovely introduction.
Pleasure. I love your work. I think it's incredible. And I can't wait to get you talking about it.
I can't wait to get you printing, but maybe that's another time.
All right, so can you tell me what it is that you do as a printmaker and illustrator?
I guess the term illustration for me is probably quite loose. I think that's just something that other people need to understand it as a job, but I've never really seen it as a job. So I am a printmaker. I like printed things. I like printing, and that's what I do, and that's what I've done for 20 years. Mm-hmm. So silkscreen is my thing. Mm-hmm. And pushing it into ways that aren't just your sort of stereotypical thoughts on how you make a silkscreen. So it's there as a process to make repeat images or repeat or posters or a commercial process. I think what I do, where I feel more like a printmaker than an illustrator, is a friend of mine described what I do as, because I couldn't put it into words, as like you kind of paint with the screen, which is, yeah, it's not quite how I'd like to see it, but it's like you're a silkscreen artist rather than a, not a commercial printer, but someone that uses it in its sort of traditional way. Mm-hmm. I just love printmaking, that's, and colour, and that's what
that's,
I do.
That's evident.
Yeah.
So for those that don't know the silkscreen process, could you maybe just give a little overview of how it works?
It's probably easier to do that sort of classic Andy Warhol. He's probably the... If people don't know what silkscreen are, they'll know his artwork, and that's a silkscreen process, but his is turned into a painting. So I guess he's painting with a screen as well. Mm-hmm. But it's a photographic process, or stencils, paper stencils, but it's a way of making repeat imagery by pushing ink through a mesh. The more control you have over the process, the more exactly repetitive each print will be. Mm-hmm. So I work in a completely the opposite way, an unorthodox way, whereas I don't want anything to be controlled. I predominantly make one-off images or artworks or very small editions, and within the edition I quite like each artwork or print to be unique. So I'm sort of using it as a way to make marks, but not to repeat myself. So yeah, I guess it's like, to the sort of untrained mind, maybe like a human photocopier where you're making, you're putting, you know, a facsimile of an image down with ink onto paper or to cloth in that way.
So can you give me a bit of an overview of how you've arrived at now? What was the process
I did the sort of formal A-levels, which were terrible, not very good, but basically enough to get onto a foundation art course. Mm-hmm. So I studied in Ipswich in Suffolk, mm-hmm. and that year was probably one of the most key years for me as a creative, because I went there literally with a bundle of, I'd only used charcoal and a pencil, mm-hmm. and the guy doing the interviews said, if more people had applied, you wouldn't have got in. And I knew, because I opened my folder up and it was like there were three little pieces of paper. It was so terrible. I got a place, yeah. and actually then it was really blew my mind, because there were painting studios and printmaking studios, and you did things together. You had big drawing projects, and I was using materials that I'd never used before, and I thought, oh, this is art school. And actually, nowadays, being a sort of form of a teacher or educator myself, they're sort of phasing that out. Mm. And I've even done interviews, and we're taking students from A-levels, and it's like, oh, it breaks my heart. It's such an important year or 2 years if you do it as a BTEC or whatever it is now. So, yeah, I went to Ipswich to do that, and I really liked printmaking. I sort of printed onto paper really then, and it was oil based. It was a very long process. And then I saw this course at Middlesex University that was printed textiles. And instead of it being a very tight textile course, I went to a show there, and it was like big wall hangings, and it was like just big paintings, but on fabric, mm-hmm. silk paintings. And I was like, that's amazing. I'd like to do that. So I applied for it, and I had a much better portfolio then. I wasn't confident that I'd get in, but I thought I've got as good a chance as anybody. Yeah. And I did get in, and I was really shocked actually, mm-hmm. but pleased. So I did a degree in printed textiles there. Mm-hmm. And I think as a course, it was somewhere between sort of non-conceptual fine art, painting and textiles. So it was somewhere in the middle. Mm. Then I graduated from that, and we had a lovely degree show in the Mall Galleries right in town. And we had this show, and literally from there I got interest and things took off.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, they took off in a sort of funny way, but when I look back on it and I think of my tutees when they graduate, mm-hmm. now, I have anxiety over how it is going to be for them. Mm. But when we graduated, it felt like a time that was full of, like, that things could happen. Mm. Whereas now I don't feel that for them. Things can happen, but there's just so many people. You know, definitely, it's sort of, there's so many people at university, isn't there? Because it's bums on seats, and each one has a price on their head. So it's a business, yeah. So I graduated, and I thought, I'm going to stay in London. My parents had moved to different places. I didn't feel like I had somewhere to go back to. A lot of people left. I felt a bit overwhelmed. And then I thought, I'm just going to sign on and get housing benefit. I'm going to enjoy the summer. Yeah. So there I was, signing on the first day that I could. And I carried on sort of painting at home. Mm-hmm. And basically that's what I was doing. I was just painting on paper, because that's all I could do. I was living in one room, no lounge. It's just how it's sharing with a friend. And that's just how it was. So we did a show as a university called New Designers, mm-hmm. And they sort of asked a few people from that graduating year to represent Middlesex, and it was sponsored by Habitat, run by a guy called Ian Rennick then, and they gave little bursaries out for people whose work had inspired them in the show, and they gave me 500 quid, which felt like £5,000.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow. And they said, just buy some paint with it and make some stuff and come and see us.
That's
amazing.
Like,
okay. I was like, okay, so that's what I did. I just sort of carried on painting, and I really enjoyed it. And I made sort of 30 paintings on paper. I had 2 part-time cleaning jobs, mm-hmm. that I loved. Yeah. Like, it was a day off. Yeah. It's like, I'm going to go and make that house look lovely. I'm going to get paid, and I'm not going to worry about it. And everything was kind of manageable. Yeah. It felt good. Anyway, so I would do a batch of paintings, phone up Habitat at head office, see if Ian was there, mm-hmm. or whoever in the design team was, and I'd take them into the head office on Tottenham Court Road, Good Street, and he'd have the first pick. So he'd pick out the ones he'd wanted to buy, and literally it would go down the ranks. And any that were left, we'd just put up in the walls in their stores. I know, it seems like the most bizarre.
That's amazing. And did he set that scheme in place? Or?
Well, he sort of set an interest up, mm-hmm. and then it became more formal, and they got this guy called Ben Weaver in to set up, like, I can't remember what it was called, but it was like an art the art side of habitat, so fine artists having their paintings reproduced onto posters and mm-hmm. being sold in the mm-hmm. store, or giving them a space to exhibit. And then it kind of went more fine art mm-hmm. or more, I don't know, and I got the hump that I was like, well, I was doing that, but I'm not part of that. Mm. So does that make me an illustrator? I don't want to be an illustrator. I don't like that term. Yeah. So it was a bit like that. Uh-huh. So I decided that I'd apply for an MA part-time. I thought, I need a studio and I can't afford one. Mm-hmm. I'll apply for an MA at St. Martin's part-time, and it cost 500 quid a year, and I could still get housing benefit. And I thought, result, yeah. that might work for Amazing. Me. Didn't get in. So that was a shame. And then 3 days later, I got a letter saying a couple of people didn't take their place and you were next on the list. So I did get in. So I then went to do 2 years part-time MA in, they call it communication studies, but I was sort of floating around between, I was quite, graphic illustration mm-hmm. was really what I was doing. But what I wanted was, I wanted to get in the print room, and I couldn't afford to do it. There weren't all these sort of pop-up places now like Print Club that you can pay by the mm-hmm. hour to print. So I thought, I need some studio space. That was all very good, actually, but the studios weren't very interesting. There was no space to leave things. It was, instead of one of those big, lovely old St. Martin's buildings, I was in the office block tagged on to Southampton Row, that they the overspill.
Yeah.
And it sort of had, because it was an office block, it had windows all the way around and no sort of wall space to pin things up.
Yeah.
And a photocopier. And that was about all we had, really. But you can use any of those buildings, any of the libraries. It's a very inspiring place to be. So that, I think, just gave me 2 more years to make. I could also work at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I had an office job part-time making fake books in a publisher's for publishing fairs, like
fake
Frankfurt.
Books.
Fake books, yeah.
What's a fake book?
It's a dummy. A dummy book, yeah. But I'm a bit obsessive. Well, quite obsessive. So I made them look like an actual book. Yeah. Yeah. So that's something I did, and I worked in town, and I could go to college from there. Yeah.
So often when we hear print, we assume it's on paper. Mm-hmm. But you also create for textiles and fashion, and have created displays printed on perspex.
Yes.
Can you take us through kind of the range of possibilities for printmaking?
So I trained in print, but on fabric, mm-hmm. and one of the reasons I moved on to paper was printing onto cloth is really very time consuming. Mm-hmm. For each type of cloth or each fibre, there's a certain set of inks that you would use. One set is for silk, you would need to steam them, you'd need a steamer, or it's just so long-winded. So what I knew that I just liked was using a screen to make a mark and then lifting it up and seeing what was underneath. Mm-hmm. So I thought, okay, we'll move on to paper. And then originally, you know, 20 years ago, everyone was using oil-based inks. Then they brought in acrylic, plastic, mm-hmm. water-based inks, mm-hmm. and it was a complete game-changer because it meant you can set something up quite quickly, even at home. Mm-hmm. You don't need any kind of extraction because it's not carcinogenic, it's not oil-based, you're not cleaning with the spirit. Mm-hmm. So that allowed me to print. So for me now, when I print on to the acrylic perspex you were talking about, it will go, you can print on any surface really that's predominantly flat. Mm-hmm. And if it's not really flat, then you might get an interesting effect from mm-hmm. it. So I don't really print on fabric now, and any fabric prints that I have done, I have a bit of a battle with, because really they're digitally printed. Mm-hmm. So instead of printing onto a fabric, I will make a screen print onto paper, scan it, and for me, it just looks digital. There's some people that do it really well, but when you're trained as a textile designer, you feel like that's kind of cheating, really. Mm-hmm. I can't quite decide what I feel about it, but mm-hmm. I think what I'm wary of is there's a lot of sort of crap digital printing mm-hmm. onto things. Like, it is an art in itself, and that's important to me. So I would like to print on fabric, but I don't so much now. Mm-hmm. With the screen, really, you can print onto wood, paper, plastic, anything really.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious then, just talking about the digital aspect and then the hand and the craft and the separation between the two, what
yeah.
you're doing. Why do you think, or why are you more drawn to the process that is less digital or more analog, for want of a better word?
So I share a studio with another artist, Sophie Smallhorn, and she had an assistant in, and she was helping her on the computer. And at the end of the day, I said, I just need to know how to draw a straight line in Illustrator, which is like a really basic thing to do. I was doing something for my brother and I can't do it. And she said, oh, you just do it like this. And I said, oh, I tried to do it. And I sort of did it like that. And she said, well, that's a logical way to do it. It just takes a lot longer, but I can see why you would do that. And she said, if you learn more Illustrator or more Photoshop, it might ruin the sort of integrity of your artwork. Like, there's nothing wrong with how you do things. I think I have a sort of chip on my shoulder that I want to know everything. Mm-hmm. So I want to be really good at Photoshop, even if I don't really use it. Yeah. And I think when I left college, there weren't mobile phones. The internet was just starting. Mm-hmm. I like process, and the process in a digital format is less interesting to me. I like physically doing things. I like cleaning the screens and mixing the inks and being on my feet when I'm working and moving around, and it's all part of it rather than sitting at a desk behind a computer. Mm. It is a double-edged sword, because it also, knowing some Photoshop, for example, allows me to get out of situations and speed up my work and probably make better work. If I'm doing a job for somebody and I'm using a photograph and the face is too dark on the picture, mm-hmm. I now know how to change that and lighten it a bit. And years ago, I would have been completely scuppered, and I wouldn't, you know, it just looked like not a very good print. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, it really helps me, and I probably couldn't be without it now. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I just like having a more physical involvement with what I do rather than staring at a screen. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's an ongoing battle, but I am enjoying learning to use programs without any formal training.
Yeah. So can you talk about your methods of experimentation in your printmaking? Because it's quite integral to what you do and your practice.
Yeah. Because I print, make, or silkscreen in an unorthodox way, I'm learning on the job, and I'm learning from the process and the funny little things that might happen, also known as happy accidents. Mm-hmm. And that's what inspires me, because I'm constantly learning still about something that I've done for 20 years, and that's why I like silkscreen, because it just keeps on giving, really. Sometimes it's hard to go back and work out how you did something. So often that is why I don't use it as a repeat method, because I'm using it in the wrong way, mm-hmm. I guess. But it's all those little chance, all those opportunities and those happy accidents that teaches me new things and new aesthetics that I can then dollop onto the next idea. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when I think about what I do, I think about it as just like one big long job, one big long creative process, yeah. A stream of consciousness, I guess, yeah. of printmaking. Uh-huh. Because when you're still discovering things about a technique as you go along, that's how I kind of view it. Predominantly when I teach, I'm just giving one-to-one tutorials with tutees, and I'm not in the print room. I think people think I teach silkscreen. One, I can't teach silkscreen because I'm not a formal, I couldn't teach technically. But I will do little workshops for them, and I think sometimes I've pissed a few technicians off because I'm sort of messy and haphazard, and it's not, the image isn't right in the middle of the screen with enough space around it for the ink to be there. It's just, let's get as much stuff on screen as we can. We won't lock the screen down in a framework. We'll just move it around the table, use each other's, mm-hmm. use blank screens, paint into them, just kind of play with it and see what happens. And I think a lot of students are very frightened of doing that because there is a way that you're supposed to do mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. But I think then what happens is they end up with a pile of printed papers that they're like, oh my god, look at all these marks, I didn't realize. And then I say, well, look, even if they just look like sort of mistakes to you, scan them all in and then continue the process somewhere else. Obviously most of them work on the computer. Mm-hmm. I make controlled happy accidents, mm-hmm. I guess, really. Yeah. I can control it enough to fulfill a commercial brief, mm-hmm. as well. Now took a long time to get into that, to know how to do that. Yeah. But I can.
So I guess two things there are. First thing, what is an unorthodoxed way? So you were talking about different mark making then, about moving the frame not being locked around. But if you're explaining to a complete novice who has never done a silkscreen process, what is that and how does a happy accident happen?
If you were making a cake and you were following a recipe, yeah. there's an orthodox manner to mm-hmm. your step one, step mm-hmm. two. Mm-hmm. So there is a kind of set of rules around silkscreen. Mm-hmm. If you'd never done it before and someone gave you a book on it, and this is how you do it, there's a set of rules there. But that's only to make very regimented things mm-hmm. that look exactly the same. Mm.
So one thing when I was researching it, you were saying, I love the thing that then the screen is falling apart and fraying or whatever.
Yeah.
You keep using it. I thought that's awesome.
Yeah, so that's a good way of looking at things that are slightly rule-breaking. So if you were making a commercial set of prints and you wanted them all to look the same, for each time you might clean the screen off, and you'd probably start with a pretty clean, perfect screen and expose your images. You'd mix your inks up beforehand. You'd know exactly where you were going to put everything, and you'd use registration. If I was going to do it, one of the first things I would do is I wouldn't use brand new screens because they just make really perfect images. And I find if you make a really perfect screen print, it can also look like a digital print. So why not just do a digital print? So because I like things that have texture and that are distressed and are nostalgic, I keep a batch of screens that are old screens that will never clean properly. So you've got like bits of old jobs on them. So you might print something and you'll see a piece of an old job in there, but no one will know. But I think that's what gives a sort of nostalgia and a kind of clarity to my work. But also there's a feeling of people aren't quite sure that they feel other things about it. Maybe because there's a sort of remnants of other things on there. Yeah. It's like how a photo ages or something. I just like what I do to have a tactile quality that kind of is slightly resonant to something in your life or reminds you of something. I guess I'm sentimental.
And I guess the second part to that would be, you mentioned commerciality and being able to sell work and considering that in the process of making something different or unique. What was the process for you to getting to that point, to being able to sell work?
When I was at St. Martin's, so in the middle of the second year, I made some collages and some pieces of work that I felt confident about and I felt were that's me doing my thing, and I never knew what my thing was. I knew my thing was printing and I knew I loved textiles, but I wasn't able to do that. So in those days, I got these collages, I put them on the colour copier, found a go, made some copies of them, folded them up and sent them out to people, mainly to design groups and art buyers that were kind of making commercial projects that I thought I could be involved in. So I sent them to a design group called Blue Source, and soon after that they got in touch and they said, oh, we have a band called Mono, we need a campaign, and they really like your work, do you want to come in and meet them? And I was like, oh, that's how it works, is it? So before I'd graduated, I had made this sort of set of sleeves for this band, and they were, I think their sort of notoriety was because their album was a soundtrack for a Robert De Niro film at that time. But that made me realise that even if you do things that aren't formal, or I don't fall into a box like you're an illustrator or you're a painter or you're this, I realised that I could still make things that were used in a commercial way and had value in that way. So I learned kind of on the job. And after that job, I felt like, oh, I've got something of merit in my portfolio because a record. Now, instead of lugging around a big, massive A1 folder with prints on a rigged up trolley device, I could just take a bunch of records out and go, look, I've done these. So I had the confidence to then make appointments to see people.
Yeah. Amazing. And your print covers on George Orwell's?
Oh, see, I have that. What's that imposter syndrome around that? Because I've never read any of his books, not one, which is terrible.
Not really. You don't need to read them to make an amazing
cover. I know, but it just feels like I should have a little bit more integrity around his writing and what he does. And
you get to
and,
it.
Yeah, Google synopsis, that's what that was. Got a laptop. Oh, type this in. So I would literally put a title in. It'd give you a paragraph on what it was about, and I'd be like, okay, I need an island, a man that makes a mask, it's like a monkey, and there's a massive sort of wave in it. Oh, I've done a cover. So I would just look for words to kind of collage together.
I think there's something nice about being distanced from something and having a flavour of something, because you're reading it in a different way then, without trying to be so prescribed. I think it can shut you in.
I think it's just a matter of seeing things in a different way, isn't it? I was so overwhelmed, really. And then once you've got off on the kind of enjoyment and the fact that you're going to get quite well paid for it as well, and they want like 15 covers. And then after I'd done a few, I kind of got into the rhythm of doing it, but they were quite short turnarounds. You know, once you'd got a few under your belt, you'd go in and to Penguin and meet the art director. He would be really helpful as well. I think I've always been someone that thought that I have to do everything myself. I have to have all the answers and that I can't ask the editor or the art director for any advice. It was such a nice thing to do.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Who are your clients now and how do they find you?
So I have an agent called Big Active, and then Instagram is the other. So I got the agent after doing the surrender campaign for the Chemical Brothers. They approached me, and it was amazing because suddenly, like, there were, you know, people putting your portfolio together and helping you do things, and it was great. It goes in and out of I'm busy, I'm not busy, but I've never been very commercial, so I'm never going to be really busy with an agent. Like, I know Greg and Alistair well now, and I'll say, who's got all the work? And they'll be like, what are you asking that for? So just, I'm genuinely interested on a, because I want to see how their work is reformatted or how commercial I think someone is. So I will ask them things like that. And sometimes, so I will get more of the kind of music related or advertising related or corporate art kind of things go through them. And then the other side of things is I love Instagram. Just for my visual diary, it's brilliant. And also people do say, oh, that's nice. You know, is it for sale? Or I saw your work on Instagram. We make, you know, we're making some music. Would you do some covers? So I think it covers both end of the spectrum. But that is really how I get work. I still run a blog, but I don't think anyone reads blogs anymore. But I was very into that when I did it. But again, that's how, social media, I guess, and being with Big Active.
Okay. So what is your creative process when working on a brief?
What I find hard about that nowadays is it always used to start by you going in and meeting the client and discussing work. And I always take prints with me because it just seems to be a deal breaker. And I feel when people actually see a print, the mutual understanding seems to gel much quicker. And I can see what they're doing and we talk everything through. Now, that doesn't really happen nowadays. So it is hard. I guess usually I try and put a process in place where if someone gives me a brief, I have my initial set ideas and I will reference, I'll break it down and I'll reference their ideas of pieces of existing work or tests, printed tests or something that I've made. So we've always got a visual with the text. Because I think if that doesn't happen, you can have a big, long conversation on the phone and you're like, God, that went really well. I think we're really on the same page and you're completely talking about different things. And it happens. And I just thought, how am I going to remedy that? So I guess nowadays what I'll do is I've learned to use Photoshop a bit more or just using your, you know, a camera of some or your, a snap on your phone to take a picture of a working drawing or loose collage that you've put together, you kind of digitize that and it looks more like a thing, a rough. And then as soon as I can, I just like to get something on screen and basically run images off just in one color. Because the minute that your imagery is treated by the silkscreen process, then they know what they're going to get, and then we can take it, you know, start injecting color into it.
So is there a typical work day for you?
So most days I get up and I go and do an exercise class because then I've done that and then I'm in the right zone. I know I've got the whole day free to make things and be creative and it's given me the energy and, and given me some focus. It's only something I've done in the last few years, but it really helps. Each day I make a lot of lists and then I make lists from the list. Just reprioritising as things come in and out and what I need to be. And then you think, oh, I'm all lovely and organised. And then a job will come in, you're like, oh God, I haven't done the other things that I was going to do for the print fair that's now in 6 weeks' time and I've got to do. So it's just a sort of mishmash of trying to have some structure and knowledge and making sure that the studio is functioning. You're just running a little workshop and seeing how that is.
Cool. I love lists.
Oh my God, I know.
Do you do, I do this where I have a list for one day and then it's done. And then stuff hanging over. So then I just transfer it to the next list on the next page, right next to it.
Absolutely. And then I upgraded my phone and I realised that you can make a list and then you can share that list with other people. And then when you add to it, it adds to that. I was like, so I just sent it to myself. I didn't want to share it.
But
it was like, just a reminder. I was like, this is getting a bit, that's time wasting, I think, for me on that.
Organisation, I call it.
Yeah, you have to be, that's something that the students always ask me about. How do you sort of set up your day or how do you, you know, I know for, especially sort of creative brains, we can be naturally quite anxious or quite worried or unconfident or overconfident. We're all these different things, aren't we? And I think a lot of them, I get a lot of students contacting me when they've graduated going, oh, I'm unmotivated, or a job's come in and I don't know how to make a costing for it. Can you help me? Or I've got no ideas. It, just many, many different things. Yeah. So it's sort of learning how to... finding a routine for yourself.
I think it's also easy to get creatively distracted. So you actually are being creative, but you're probably not focusing on what you need to.
Yeah.
That's another thing for creative people,
that is,
I find.
True.
Yeah, I find that with myself. It's like, you're doing lots of work here, but it's not the work you should be doing.
Yeah. I guess it's that the bigger the job in the sort of financial side of things, often is the less creative, isn't it? And you'll do something for free, or do you do something just because someone's asked you, and it's a thing you spend more time on, you enjoy more.
So you were just talking about teaching, so can you talk about, what does this give your practice?
Do you know what, it gives me so much, and at the moment I'm not teaching and I'm really missing it. I like that it breaks my week up, that my week isn't solely thinking about my work. I love seeing how their brains work. I love how you give them a brief and there's 20 of them and they all approach it in a completely different way. So that can be inspiring as well. And I like the role of being a mentor and having some answers and not trying to do too much. I like being a tutor that cares and is reliable and gives them as much time. I mean, you definitely don't teach for the money. So it's my way of giving back.
So what skills do you need to be a printmaker and illustrator?
You have to be objective over your own work and to know when you're making something that's good and to know when it's not working, and at the same token to take it on the chin if you think it's working and the client doesn't. So it's that sort of trying not to take it personally type thing. That's quite hard. But I think I wouldn't really be able to explain it. It was just, I carried on doing what I did at college and just kept going in it, and then make sure I reinvent myself along the way. Kept getting work. I mean, there's been some terrible periods where I was just like, I remember my mum saying, I mean, what else can you do? And I was like, I don't know what else. And I was like, Jesus, it's not got that bad. It's just self-employment. It's just, that's just how it is.
Okay. So maybe you can talk about maybe what is one of your biggest challenges you've faced in your career.
The biggest challenges I face is not to pour every sense of creative fulfillment in every job. To not have to be sort of creatively and emotionally satisfied in everything I do and just care a bit less about it. And it's true, because actually it's exhausting otherwise. And I think that's something I find really hard. I feel like whether it's something that is very quick with little financial reward, or I still have to give it everything. And in the last few years, I've been trying to do that a bit less. And actually, doesn't really feel that different, but I feel mentally, I feel stronger and lighter, and I enjoy things more. So it's that sort of less giving yourself a hard time, or just accepting that sometimes, you know, the jobs don't go as well as you'd like them to. The hardest thing is a client or a company will ask you to work for them and you're like, oh my god, Apple have asked me to do something, that's amazing, but you've only got 48 hours to do it, and you're like, oh my god, so that's so harsh.
Yeah, that's pretty challenging.
Yeah, so many people are going to see that and it might not be what I want it to be. And you have to just let all that go, and that is really hard.
You give everything to them, you're almost burning yourself out because you're so desperate for it to be exactly how you see it or feel it. And when you don't quite achieve it, then the self-critical voice comes in, and then
you go through this
crazy cycle. And
And at the end of that, instead of thinking, wow, the job's finished, I've got some time to, see an exhibition, you're just mentally exhausted and in a terrible mood. That's not how you should feel.
And I don't want to ever look at it again.
Yeah,
and
then maybe ever mention it.
A month later, I'll look at it.
I feel very lucky to do what I do and have a nice studio and do something that I really enjoy doing.
Yeah. Which is a lovely segue into, what do you love about being a printmaker?
That moment when you pull the squeegee across and you lift the screen up, it's different every time. It's never boring. I mean, it might be a disaster, but it's always, you never know. Because that's a good way to explain the unorthodox kind of thing. If you printed in a very regulated way, you would know exactly what would be under there.
Yeah.
And I don't. That's what I love about being a printmaker.
Okay. So what advice would you give to someone considering a career in printmaking?
You need to be able to look after yourself financially and mentally, because being self-employed is really hard. Mm-hmm. So I always think of that probably more than the creative side. A lot of people that are creative aren't naturally like that. And then on top of that, you have to retain a sense of passion for everything and to be feeling inspired. And there's so many ways you can scupper yourself and put yourself off what you're doing by looking at other people's work and going, oh my God, that's amazing. I might as well just stop. Yeah. Or comparing, or all those things you do when you're not actually just focusing on making your own work. You know, if you're worrying about your rent, you don't feel that creative.
No, not at all.
That's the problem.
I've been there. Yeah.
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 My inspiration comes from so many different places and different areas, and, you know, just be open to do more than what you think you want to do. So you don't just have to be printmaking all day.
So we're coming to the end of the interview. I've loved being here in your studio. It's so gorgeous.
Thank you.
So what have you got coming up in the next few weeks or months?
Potentially a couple of music related jobs. At the end of the day, I love being involved in that world. Yeah. I love music. I love meeting artists. I love trying to come up with a visual solution to what they've created. And I love receiving the record at the end of the day and holding it in my hand. Yeah. As an actual thing. So there's some music jobs that may or may not come off. I've got this fair that I'm doing at the end of June. I'd really like to get some more teaching, but I mean, that year, May, they'll be having their shows soon. Yeah. So I should sort of make a bit more of an effort actually to try and do that. And I'd love to do a residency somewhere. I've never done that. Probably because I just thought, how will I fund myself while I'm doing it, and all those kind of practical things. And then another thing that's coming up, I can't really talk about, but it will be the first time I've done something, is a friend of mine has a clothing label. Uh-huh. And I've known him for 20 years. And finally, we've got to work together and we've made a small collection. So I've done the sort of imagery and some patterns and different things that he's applied to garments, and that will be launched soon to see if anyone wants to buy
that's
it.
And awesome.
So that would be really, I'm literally waiting for the pictures to come through today. We had some samples made, and
we need to keep an eye on your really Instagram.
Yeah. I mean, the minute I can say something, yeah. I will.
Yeah, cool. All right, before I finish up, something I always ask everyone is there a career or job in the creative industries that you know a little about, you'd like to know more about? Potentially I could get someone on the podcast to chat to them about that role. And secondly, a woman that you would recommend or suggest to come on Greater Than 11%.
Sophie, that I share the studio with, her practice is beautiful. She sits next to me, you know, making beautiful things, and we have a working relationship that is really interesting. But I'd love to hear her. I spend more time talking about the archers than I do about pontificating about that than I do about maybe our process, because you don't just, you know, so it'd be really nice to hear her.
And what does she make?
Predominantly she makes sculptural pieces dealing with colour. Yeah, she's just done this beautiful set of installations in COS.
Yes.
Stores. Yeah, she did that last year. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to know more, but I'd like just to hear her. I think she'd be maybe a bit shy, but I'd like to hear her talk about her process
more.
Awesome.
I'll try and get her on.
Yeah. And then I have a younger friend. She comes from a sort of dance background, and she does choreography, and she does kind of coaching, and she helped me. Her name is Emma Zangs. Mm-hmm. And she helped me. I was going to do some lectures, and she said, listen, you're so nervous, come on, I'll give you some coaching. And she helped me with that. But she's so kind and gives people time and brings the best out in people in so many different creative ways. Uh-huh. Whether it's a physical thing, or I'd love to hear her.
Yeah,
in
great.
I'd like to have a good chunk of her philosophy.
Uh-huh.
Definitely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome.
But I mean, I the list could go on.
Yeah.
I'd like to know more about set design. I'd love to know more about that, because I feel like nowadays jobs are merging and people are swapping ideas and swapping their talents and collaborating. And so that would be, I'd love to do something like that. And I know nothing about it, and I don't know if it's possible, but I'd like to know more about the technical side of that and how it's achieved. And I just think it's so clever.
Yeah,
on that scale. Oh, I went to the all-male Swan Lake at Sadler's Wells.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it Bourne? Matthew Bourne.
Yeah.
And the dancing alone is amazing.
Yeah.
But just the sets and the lighting and how you can change a mood and a space so quickly, it fascinates me. Yeah. So okay. That would, I think that's what I would say.
Great.
For that. Oh, thank you. This is my first podcast. Thank you very much.
Well, you've been wonderful. Thank you so much. No,
you've made me feel really relaxed. So thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed, please write a review and rate, as that helps other people find Greater Than 11%. Also, stay subscribed to keep up to date on the weekly releases. This podcast is made possible by the support of Hub, an insight-led content agency based in London. A huge thank you to the producers, Pat Murray and James Haverson, and to our editors, Daniel Clark and Laura Francis, and to Maria Continenza for designing the beautiful artwork.